normal man wanted to go. Phrases you did not want to leave on your internet search history. But also, unfortunately, tasks you did not want to delegate. He contemplated the search box he had emptied, the cursor blinking dispassionately at him, then typed fast in his usual two-fingered style. Donald Lang. There were plenty of them, especially in Scotland, but he could rule out anyone who had been paying rent or voting in elections while Lang had been in jail. After careful elimination, and bearing in mind Lang's approximate age, Strike narrowed his focus to a man who appeared to have been living with a woman called Lorraine McNaughton in Corby in 2008. Lorraine McNaughton was now registered as living there alone. He deleted Lang's name and substituted Noel Brockbank. There were fewer of them in the UK than there had been Donald Lang's, but Strike reached a similar dead end. There had been an NC Brockbank living alone in Manchester in 2006, but if that was Strike's man, it suggested that he had split up with his wife. Strike was not sure whether that would be a good or a bad thing. Slumping back in Robin's chair, Strike moved on to considering the likely consequences of being sent an anonymous severed leg. The police would have to ask the public for information soon, but Wardle had promised to warn Strike before they gave a press conference. A story this bizarre and grotesque would always be news, but interest would be increased, and it gave him no pleasure to reflect on it, because the leg had been sent to his office. Cormoran Strike was newsworthy these days. He had solved two murders under the noses of the Met, both of which would have fascinated the public, even had a private detective not solved them. The first, because the victim had been a beautiful young woman. The second, because it had been a strange, ritualistic killing. How, Strike wondered, would the sending of the leg affect the business he had been working so hard to build up? He could not help feeling that the consequences were likely to be serious. Internet searches were a cruel barometer of status. Sometime soon, Googling Cormoran Strike would not return to the top of the page glowing encomiums on his two most famous and successful cases, but the brutal fact that he was a man in receipt of a body part, a man who had at least one very nasty enemy. Strike was sure he understood the public well enough, or at least the insecure, frightened and angry section of it that was the private investigator's bread and butter, to know they were unlikely to be drawn to a business that received severed legs in the post. At best, new clients would assume that he and Robin had troubles enough of their own, at worst, that they had, through recklessness or ineptitude, got into something way over their heads. He was about to turn off the computer when he changed his mind. And, with even more reluctance than he had brought to the job of searching for his mother in the nude, typed in Brittany Brockbank. There were a few of them on Facebook, on Instagram, working for companies of which he had never heard, beaming out of selfies. He scrutinized the images. They were nearly all in their 20s, the age she would be now. He could discount those who were black, but there was no telling which of the others, brunette, blonde or redhead, pretty or plain, photographed beaming or moody, or caught unawares, was the one he sought. None were wearing glasses. Was she too vain to wear them in a picture? Had she had her eyes lasered? Perhaps she eschewed social media. She had wanted to change her name, he remembered that. Or perhaps the reason for her absence was more fundamental. She was dead. He looked at his watch again. Time to go and change. It can't be her, he thought, and then, let it not be her. Because if it was her, it was his fault. Chapter 6. Is it any wonder that my mind's on fire? Blue Oyster Cult, Flaming Telepaths. Robin was unusually vigilant on the journey home that evening. surreptitiously comparing every man in the carriage with her memory of the tall figure in black leathers who had handed her the gruesome package. A thin young Asian man in a cheap suit smiled hopefully as she caught his eye for the third time. After that, she kept her eyes on her phone, exploring, when reception permitted, the BBC website and wondering, like Strike, when the leg would become news. 40 minutes after leaving work, she entered the large Waitrose near her home station. The fridge at home had almost nothing in it. Matthew did not enjoy food shopping, and, although he had denied it during their last row but one, she was sure that he thought she, who contributed less than a third of the household income, ought to bolster her contribution by performing those mundane tasks he did not like. Single men in suits were filling their baskets and trolleys with ready meals. Professional women hurried past, grabbing pasta that would be quick to cook for the family. An exhausted-looking young mother, with a tiny baby screaming in its buggy, wove around the aisles like a groggy moth, unable to focus, a single bag of carrots in her basket. Robin moved slowly up and down the aisles, feeling oddly jumpy. There was nobody there who resembled the man in black motorcycle leathers. Nobody who might be lurking, fantasizing about cutting off Robin's legs.
Cutting off my legs.
"Excuse me," said a cross, middle-aged woman, trying to reach the sausages. Robin apologized and moved aside, surprised to find that she was holding a pack of chicken thighs. Throwing it into her trolley, she hurried off to the other end of the supermarket, where, among the wines and spirits, she found relative quiet. Here, she pulled out her mobile and called Strike. He answered on the second ring.
"Are you all right?"
"Yes, of course. Where are you?"
"Waitrose." A short, balding man was perusing the shelf of sherry just behind Robin, his eyes level with her breasts. When she moved aside, he moved with her. Robin glared. He blushed and moved away.
"Well, you should be okay in Waitrose."
"Hmm," said Robin, her eyes on the bald man's retreating back.
"Listen, this might be nothing, but I've just remembered. We've had a couple of weird letters in the last few months."
"Nutter letters.
Don't start."
Robin always protested at this blanket term. They had attracted a significant increase in oddball correspondence since Strike had solved his second high-profile murder case. The most coherent of the writers simply asked for money on the assumption that Strike was now immensely rich. Then came those who had strange personal grudges that they wished Strike to avenge, those whose waking hours seemed devoted to proving outlandish theories, those whose needs and wishes were so inchoate and rambling that the only message they conveyed was mental illness, and finally, "Now these seem nutty," Robin had said, a sprinkling of people, both male and female, who seemed to find Strike attractive.
"Addressed to you?"
Strike asked, suddenly serious.
"No, you."
She could hear him moving around his flat as they talked. Perhaps he was going out with Ellen tonight. He never talked about the relationship. If Ellen had not dropped by the office one day, Robin doubted that she would have known that she existed. Perhaps not until he turned up for work one day wearing a wedding ring.
"What did they say?" asked Strike.
"Well, one of them was from a girl who wanted to cut off her own leg. She was asking for advice."
"Say that again."
"She wanted to cut off her own leg," Robin enunciated clearly, and a woman choosing a bottle of rosé nearby threw her a startled look.
"Jesus Christ," muttered Strike, "and I'm not allowed to call them nutters. You think she managed it and thought I'd like to know?"
"I thought a letter like that might be relevant," said Robin repressively. "Some people do want to cut bits of themselves off. It's a recognized phenomenon. It's called not being a nutter," she added, correctly anticipating him, and he laughed. "And there was another one, from a person who signed with their initials. A long letter. They went on and on about your leg and how they wanted to make it up to you."
"If they were trying to make it up to me, You'd think they would have sent a man's leg. I'd look pretty bloody stupid.
Don't, she said. Don't joke. I don't know how you can.
I don't know how you can't, he said, but kindly.
She heard a very familiar scraping noise, followed by a sonorous clang.
You're looking in the nutter drawer.
I don't think you should call it the nutter drawer, Robin. Bit disrespectful to our mentally ill.
I'll see you tomorrow, she said, smiling against her will, and hung up on his laughter. The fatigue she had been fighting all day washed over her anew as she ambled around the supermarket. It was deciding what to eat that was effortful. She would have found it quite soothing merely to shop from a list that somebody else had prepared. Like the working mothers seeking anything quick to cook, Robin gave up and chose a lot of pasta. Queuing at the checkout, she found herself right behind the young woman whose baby had at last exhausted itself and now slept as though dead, fists flung out, eyes tight shut.
Cute, said Robin, who felt the girl needed encouragement.
When he's asleep,
the mother replied with a weak smile.
By the time Robin had let herself in at home, she was truly exhausted. To her surprise, Matthew was standing waiting for her in the narrow hall.
I shopped, he said, when he saw the four bulging shopping bags in her hands, and she heard his disappointment that the grand gesture had been undermined. I sent you a text that I was going to Waitrose.
Must have missed it, said Robin. Sorry.
She had probably been on the phone to Strike. They might even have been there at the same time, but of course she had spent half her visit skulking among the wine and spirits. Matthew walked forward, arms outstretched, and pulled her into a hug, with what she could not help but feel was infuriating magnanimity. Even so, she had to admit that he looked, as always, wonderfully handsome in his dark suit, his thick, tawny hair swept back off his forehead.
It must have been scary, he murmured, his breath warm in her hair.
It was, she said, wrapping her arms around his waist.
They ate pasta in peace, without a single mention of Sarah Shadlock, Strike, or Jacques Berger. The furious ambition of that morning to make Matthew acknowledge that it had been Sarah, not she, who had voiced admiration of curly hair, had burned out. Robin felt that she was being rewarded for her mature forbearance when Matthew said apologetically,
I'm going to have to do a bit of work after dinner.
No problem, said Robin. I wanted an early night anyway.
She took a low-calorie hot chocolate and a copy of Grazia to bed with her, but she could not concentrate. After 10 minutes, she got up and fetched her laptop, took it back to bed with her, and Googled Jeff Whittaker. She had read the Wikipedia entry before, during one of her guilty trawls through Strike's past, but now she read it with greater attention. It started with a familiar disclaimer. This article has multiple issues. This article needs additional citations for verification. This article possibly contains original research.
Jeff Whittaker.
Jeff Whittaker, born 1969, is a musician best known for his marriage to 1970s supergroupie Leda Strike, whom he was charged with killing in 1994. Whittaker is a grandson of diplomat Sir Randolph Whittaker, KCMB, DSO.
Early life.
Whittaker was raised by his grandparents. His teenage mother, Patricia Whittaker, was schizophrenic. Citation needed. Whittaker never knew who his father was. Citation needed. He was expelled from Gordonston School after drawing a knife on a member of staff. Citation needed. He claims that his grandfather locked him in a shed for 3 days following his expulsion, a charge his grandfather denies. Whittaker ran away from home and lived rough for a period during his teens. He also claims to have worked as a gravedigger. Citation needed. Musical career. Whittaker played guitar
and wrote lyrics for a succession of thrash metal bands in the late 80s and early 90s, including Restorative Art, Devil Heart, and Necromantic. Personal life. In 1991, Whittaker met Leda Strike, ex-girlfriend of Johnny Rokeby and Rick Fantoni, who was working for the record company considering signing Necromantic. Citation needed. Whittaker and Strike were married in 1992. In December of that year, she gave birth to a son, Switch LeVay Bloom Whittaker. In 1993, Whittaker was sacked from Necromantic due to his drug abuse. Citation needed. When Leda Whittaker died of a heroin overdose in 1994, Whittaker was charged with her murder. He was found not guilty. In 1995, Whittaker was rearrested for assault and attempted kidnap of his son, who was in the custody of Whittaker's grandparents. He received a suspended jail sentence for the assault on his grandfather. Citation needed. In 1998, Whittaker threatened a co-worker with a knife and received a 3-month jail sentence. In 2002, Whittaker was jailed for preventing the lawful burial of a body. Karen Abraham, with whom he had been living, was found to have died of heart failure, but Whittaker had kept her body in their shared flat for a month. In 2005, Whittaker was jailed for dealing crack cocaine. Robin read the page twice. Her concentration was poor tonight. Information seemed to slide off the surface of her mind, failing to be absorbed. Parts of Whittaker's history stood out, glaringly strange. Why would anyone conceal a corpse for a month? Had Whittaker feared that he would be charged with murder again, or was there some other reason? Bodies, limbs, pieces of dead flesh. She sipped the hot chocolate and grimaced. It tasted of flavored dust. In the pressure she felt to be slim in her wedding dress, she had forsworn chocolate in its true form for a month now. She replaced the mug on her bedside cabinet, returned her fingers to the keyboard, and searched for images of Jeff Whittaker trial. A matrix of photographs filled the screen, showing two different Whittakers, photographed 8 years apart, and entering and exiting two different courts. The young Whittaker, accused of murdering his wife, wore dreadlocks tied back in a ponytail. He had a certain seedy glamour in his black suit and tie, tall enough to see over the heads of most of the photographers crowding around him. His cheekbones were high, his skin sallow, and his large eyes set unusually far apart. The kind of eyes that might have belonged to an opium-crazed poet or a heretic priest. The Whittaker who had been accused of preventing another woman's burial had lost his vagrant handsomeness. He was heavier, with a brutal crew cut and a beard. Only the wide-set eyes were unchanged, and the aura of unapologetic arrogance. Robin scrolled slowly down through the photographs. Soon, the pictures of what she thought of as Strikes Whittaker became interspersed with pictures of other Whittakers who had been in trials. A cherubic-looking African-American called Jeff Whittaker had taken his neighbor to court for allowing his dog to repeatedly foul his lawn. Why did Strike think his ex-stepfather? She found it odd to think of him in those terms, as he was only 5 years older than Strike, would have sent him the leg. She wondered when Strike had last seen the man he thought had murdered his mother. There was so much she did not know about her boss. He did not like to talk about his past. Robin's fingers slid back to the keys and typed, Eric Bloom. The first thing that occurred to her, staring at the pictures of the leather-clad 70s rocker, was that he had Strike's exact hair, dense, dark, and curly. This reminded her of Jacques Berger and Sarah Shadlock, which did nothing to improve her mood. She turned her attention to the other two men whom Strike had mentioned as possible suspects, but she could not remember what their names had been. Donald something? And a funny name beginning with B. Her memory was usually excellent. Strike often complimented her on it. Why couldn't she remember? On the other hand, would it matter if she could? There was little you could do on a laptop to find two men who might be anywhere. Robin had not worked for a detective agency for this long without being perfectly aware that those who used pseudonyms lived rough, favoured squats, rented their accommodation, or did not add their name to electoral rolls, could easily fall through the wide mesh of directory inquiries. After sitting in thought for several more minutes, and with a sense that she was somehow betraying her boss, Robin typed "Leda Strike" into the search box, and then, feeling guiltier than ever, naked. The picture was black and white. The young Leda posed with her arms over her head, a long cloud of dark hair falling down over her breasts. Even in the thumbnail version, Robin could make out an arch of curly script set above the dark triangle of pubic hair. Squinting slightly, as though rendering the image a little fuzzy somehow mitigated her actions, Robin brought up the full-sized picture. She did not want to have to zoom in, and nor did she need to. The words "Mistress of" were clearly legible. The bathroom fan whirred into life next door. With a guilty start, Robin shut down the page she had been viewing. Matthew had lately developed a habit of borrowing her laptop, and a few weeks previously, she had caught him reading her emails to Strike. With this in mind, she reopened the web page, cleared her browsing history, brought up her settings, and after a moment's consideration, changed her password to "Don't Fear the Reaper." That would scupper him. As she slid out of bed to go and throw the hot chocolate down the kitchen sink, it occurred to Robin that she had not bothered to look up any details about Terence Digger Malley. Of course, the police would be far better placed than she or Strike to find a London gangster. "Doesn't matter, though," she thought sleepily, heading back to the bedroom. "It isn't Malley." Chapter 7. Good to Feel Hungry. Of course, if he'd had the sense he was born with. That had been a favourite phrase of his mother's, vicious bitch that she'd been. "You haven't got the sense you were born with, have you, you stupid little bastard?" If he'd had the sense he was born with, he wouldn't have followed the secretary the very day after handing her the leg. Only it had been difficult to resist the temptation when he did not know when he would next have a chance. The urge to tail her again had grown upon him in the night, to see what she looked like now that she had opened his present. From tomorrow, his freedom would be severely curtailed, because it would be home and it required his attention when it was around. Keeping it happy was very important, not least because it earned the money. Stupid and ugly and grateful for affection, it had barely noticed that it was keeping him. Once he'd seen it off to work that morning, he had hurried out of the house to wait for the secretary at her home station, which had been a smart decision, because she hadn't gone to the office at all. He had thought the arrival of the leg might disrupt her routine, and he had been right. He was nearly always right. He knew how to follow people. At some points today, he had been wearing a beanie hat. At others, he had been bareheaded. He had stripped to his T-shirt, then worn his jacket, and then his jacket turned inside out. Sunglasses on, sunglasses off. The secretary's value to him, over and above the value any female had to him if he could get her alone, was in what he was going to do through her to Strike. His ambition to be avenged on Strike, permanently, brutally avenged, had grown in him until it became the central ambition of his life. He had always been this way. If someone crossed him, they were marked, and at some point, whenever opportunity presented itself, even if it took years, they would get theirs. Cormor and Strike had done him more harm than any other human being ever, and he was going to pay a just price. He had lost track of Strike for several years, and then an explosion of publicity had revealed the bastard, celebrated, heroic. This was the status he had always wanted, had craved. It had been like drinking acid, choking down the fawning articles about the cunt. But he had devoured everything he could, because you needed to know your target if he wanted to cause maximum damage. He intended to inflict as much pain on Cormoran Strike as was not humanly possible, because he knew himself to be something more than human, as was superhumanly possible. It would go way beyond a knife in the ribs in the dark. No. Strike's punishment was going to be slower and stranger, frightening, tortuous, and finally, devastating. Nobody would ever know he'd done it. Why should they? He'd escaped without detection 3 times now. 3 women dead, and nobody had a clue who'd done it. This knowledge enabled him to read today's Metro without the slightest trace of fear. To feel only pride and satisfaction at the hysterical accounts of the severed leg. To savour the whiff of fear and confusion that rose from each story. The bleating incomprehension of the sheep-like masses who sent a wolf. All he needed now was for the secretary to take 1 short walk down a deserted stretch of road. But London throbbed and teemed with people all day long, and here he was, frustrated and wary, watching her as he hung around the London School of Economics. She was tracking someone too, and it was easy to see who that was. Her target had bright platinum hair extensions that led the secretary, mid-afternoon, all the way back to Tottenham Court Road. The secretary disappeared inside a pub opposite the lap dancing club into which her mark had gone. He debated following her inside, but she seemed dangerously watchful today. So he entered a cheap Japanese restaurant with plate glass windows opposite the pub, took a table near the window, and waited for her to emerge. It would happen, he told himself, staring through his shades into the busy road. He would get her. He had to hold on to that thought. Because this evening he was going to have to return to it and the half-life, the lie-life, that allowed the real him to walk and breathe in secret. The smeared and dusty London window reflected his naked expression. Stripped of the civilized coating he wore to beguile the women who had fallen prey to his charm and his knives. To the surface had risen the creature that lived within, the creature that wanted nothing except to establish its dominance. Chapter 8. I seem to see a rose. I reach out. Then it goes. Blue Oyster Cult, Lonely Teardrops. As Strike had been expecting, ever since the news of the severed leg hit the media, his old acquaintance Dominic Culpepper, of the News of the World, had contacted him early on Tuesday morning in a state of advanced ire. The journalist refused to accept that Strike might have had legitimate reasons for choosing not to contact Culpepper the very second he had realized that he was in receipt of a severed limb, and Strike further compounded this offense by declining the invitation to keep Culpepper informed of every fresh development in the case in return for a hefty retainer. Culpepper had previously put paid work Strike's way, and the detective suspected, by the time the call terminated, that this source of income would henceforth be closed to him. Culpepper was not a happy man. Strike and Robin did not speak until mid-afternoon. Strike, who was carrying a backpack, called from a crowded Heathrow express train. "Where are you?" he asked. "Pub opposite Spearmint Rhino," she said. "It's called the Court. Where are you?" "Coming back from the airport. Mad Dad got on the plane, thank Christ." Mad Dad was a wealthy international banker whom Strike was tailing on behalf of his wife. The couple were having an extremely contentious custody battle. The husband's departure for Chicago would mean that Strike would have a few nights' respite from observing him, as he sat in his car outside his wife's house at 4 in the morning, night vision goggles trained on his young son's window.
"I'll come and meet you," said Strike. "Sit tight, unless Platinum cops off with someone, obviously."
Platinum was the Russian economics student and lap dancer. Their client was her boyfriend, a man whom Strike and Robin had nicknamed Two Times, partly because this was the second time they had investigated a blonde girlfriend for him, and also because he seemed addicted to finding out where and how his lovers were betraying him. Robin found Two Times both sinister and pitiable. He had met Platinum at the club Robin was now watching, and Robin and Strike had been given the job of finding out whether any other men were being granted the additional favours she was now giving Two Times. The odd thing was that, little though he might believe or like it, Two Times seemed to have picked an atypically monogamous girlfriend this time. After watching her movements for several weeks, Robin had learned that she was a largely solitary creature, lunching alone with books and rarely interacting with her colleagues. "She's obviously working at the club to help pay for her course," Robin had told Strike indignantly after a week's tailing. "If Two Times doesn't want other men ogling her, why doesn't he help her out financially?"
"The main attraction is that she gives other men lap dances," Strike had replied patiently. "I'm surprised it's taken him this long to go for someone like her. Ticks all his boxes."
Strike had been inside the club shortly after they took the job, and he had secured the services of a sad-eyed brunette by the unlikely name of Raven to keep an eye on his client's girlfriend. Raven was to check in once a day to tell them what Platinum was up to and inform them immediately if the Russian girl appeared to be giving out her phone number or being over-attentive to any client. The rules of the club forbade touching or soliciting, but Two Times remained convinced, "poor sad bastard," said Strike, that he was only one among many men taking her out to dinner and sharing her bed.
"I still don't understand why we have to watch the place," Robin sighed into the phone, not for the first time. "We could take Raven's calls anywhere."
"You know why," said Strike, who was preparing to disembark. "He likes the photographs."
"But they're only of her walking to and from work."
"Doesn't matter. Turns him on. Plus, he's convinced that one of these days she's going to leave the club with some Russian oligarch."
"Doesn't this stuff ever make you feel grubby?"
"Occupational hazard," said Strike, unconcerned. "See you shortly."
Robin waited amidst the floral and gilt wallpaper. Brocade chairs and mismatched lampshades contrasted strongly with enormous plasma TVs showing football and coke ads. The paintwork was the fashionable shade of greyish in which Matthew's sister had recently painted her sitting room. Robin found it depressing. Her view of the club's entrance was slightly impeded by the wooden banisters of a staircase leading to an upper floor. Outside, a constant stream of traffic flooded left and right, plenty of red double-deckers temporarily obscuring her view of the front of the club. Strike arrived, looking irritable.
"We've lost Radford," he said,
dumping his backpack beside the high window table at which she was sitting.
"He just phoned me."
"No."
"Yep. He thinks you're too newsworthy to plant in his office now."
The press had had the story of the severed leg since 6 that morning. Wardle had kept his word to Strike and warned him ahead of time. The detective had been able to leave his attic flat in the small hours with enough clothes in his holdall for a few days' absence. He knew the press would soon be staking out the office, and not for the first time.
"And?"
said Strike, returning to Robin with a pint in his hand and easing himself up onto a bar stool.
"Khan's bottled it too. He's gonna go for an agency that doesn't attract body parts."
"Bugger,"
said Robin, and then, "What are you smirking about?"
"Nothing."
He did not want to tell her that he always liked it when she said bugger. It brought out the latent Yorkshire in her accent. They were good jobs, said Robin. Strike agreed, his eyes on the front of Spearmint Rhino.
How's Platten? Raven checked in.
As Raven had just called, Robin was able to inform Strike that there was, as ever, no news. Platinum was popular with punters, and had so far that day given three lap dances that had proceeded, judged by the rules of the establishment, in total propriety.
Read the stories? He asked,
pointing at an abandoned mirror on a nearby table. Only online, said Robin.
Hopefully it'll bring in some information, said Strike. Someone must have noticed they're missing a leg.
Ha ha, said Robin.
Too soon?
Yes, said Robin coldly.
I did some digging online last night, said Strike. Brockbank might have been in Manchester in 2006.
How do you know it was the right man?
I don't, but the guy was around the right age, right middle initial.
You remember his middle initial?
Yeah, said Strike. It doesn't look like he's there anymore, though. Same story with Lang. I'm pretty sure he was at an address in Corby in 2008, but he's moved on. How long, Strike added, staring across the street, has that bloke in the camouflage jacket and shades been in that restaurant?
About half an hour.
As far as Strike could tell, the man in sunglasses was watching him back, staring out across the street through two windows. Broad-shouldered and long-legged, he looked too large for the silver chair. With the sliding reflections of traffic and passers-by refracting off the window, Strike found it difficult to be sure, but he appeared to be sporting heavy stubble.
What's it like in there?
Robin asked, pointing towards the double doors of Spearmint Rhino under their heavy metallic awning.
In the strip club? Asked Strike, taken aback.
No, in the Japanese restaurant, said Robin sarcastically. Of course in the strip club.
It's all right, he said,
not entirely sure what he was being asked. What does it look like?
Gold mirrors, dim lighting.
When she looked at him expectantly, he said,
There's a pole in the middle, where they dance.
Not lap dances?
There are private booths for them.
What do the girls wear?
I don't know. Not much.
His mobile rang. Ellen. Robin turned her face away, toying with what looked like a pair of reading glasses on the table in front of her, but which actually contained the small camera with which she photographed Platinum's movements. She had found this gadget exciting when Strike first handed it to her, but the thrill had long since worn off. She drank her tomato juice and stared out of the window, trying not to listen to what Strike and Ellen were saying to each other. He always sounded matter-of-fact when on the phone to his girlfriend, but then it was difficult to imagine Strike murmuring endearments to anyone. Matthew called her both Robsy and Rosie Posy when he was in the right mood, which was not often these days.
At Nick and Ilse's, Strike was saying. Yeah, no, I agree, yeah. All right, you too.
He cut the call. Is that where you're going to stay? Robin asked, with Nick and Ilse. They were two of Strike's oldest friends. She had met and liked both of them on a couple of visits to the office.
Yeah, they say I can stay as long as I want.
Why not with Ellen? Asked Robin. Risking rebuff, because she was perfectly aware of the line Strike preferred to maintain between his personal and professional lives.
Wouldn't work, he said.
He didn't seem annoyed that she had asked, but showed no inclination to elaborate.
I forgot, he added, glancing back across the street to the Japanese canteen.
The table, where the man in camouflage jacket and shades had sat, was now unoccupied.
I got you this.
It was a rape alarm. I've already got one, said Robin, pulling it out of her coat pocket and showing him.
Yeah, but this one's better, said Strike, showing her its features. You want an alarm of at least 120 decibels, and it sprays them with indelible red stuff.
Mine does 140 decibels.
I still think this one's better.
Is this the usual bloke thing of thinking any gadget you've chosen must be superior to anything I've got? He laughed and drained his pint.
I'll see you later.
Where are you going?
I'm meeting Shanker.
The name was unfamiliar to her.
The bloke who sometimes gives me tip-offs I can barter with the Met, Strike explained. The bloke who told me you'd stab that police informer, remember? Who recommended me as a heavy to that gangster.
Oh, said Robin, him. You never told me what he was called.
Shanker is my best chance for finding out where Whittaker is, said Strike. He might have some information on Digger Malley as well. He runs with some of the same crowd.
He squinted across the road.
Keep an eye out for that camouflage jacket.
You're jumpy.
Bloody right I'm jumpy, Robin, he said, drawing out a pack of cigarettes, ready for the short walk to the tube. Someone sent us an effing leg.
Chapter 9. One Step Ahead of the Devil. Seeing Strike in the mutilated flesh, walking along the opposite pavement towards the court, had been an unexpected bonus. What a fat fucker he'd become since they had last seen each other, ambling up the road carrying his backpack like the dumb squaddy he had once been, without realizing that the man who had sent him a leg was sitting barely 50 yards away. So much for the great detective. Into the pub he'd gone to join Little Secretary. He was almost certainly fucking her. He hoped so anyway. That would make what he was going to do to her even more satisfying. Then, as he had stared through his sunglasses at the figure of Strike sitting just inside the pub window, he thought that Strike turned and looked back. Of course, he couldn't make out features from across the road, through two panes of glass and his own tinted lenses. But something in the distant figure's attitude, the full disc of its face turned in his direction, had brought him to a high pitch of tension. They had looked at each other across the road, and the traffic growled past in either direction, intermittently blocking them from view. He had waited until three double-deckers had come crawling end to end into the space between them, then slid out of his chair, through the glass doors of the restaurant, and up the side street. Adrenaline coursed through him as he stripped off his camouflage jacket and turned it inside out. There could be no question of binning it. His knives were concealed inside the lining. Around another corner, he broke into a flat-out run.
Chapter 10. With No Love from the Past. Blue Oyster Cult, Shadow of California. The unbroken stream of traffic obliged Strike to stand and wait before crossing Tottenham Court Road, his eyes sweeping the opposite pavement. When he reached the other side of the street, he peered through the window of the Japanese restaurant. But there was no camouflage jacket to be seen, nor did any of the men in shirts or T-shirts resemble the sunglasses wearer in size or shape. Strike felt his mobile vibrate and pulled it out of his jacket pocket. Robin had texted him. Get a grip. Grinning, Strike raised a hand of farewell towards the windows of the court and headed off towards the tube. Perhaps he was just jumpy, as Robin had said. What were the odds that the nutter who had sent the leg would be sitting watching Robin in broad daylight? Yet he had not liked the fixed stare of the big man in the camouflage jacket, nor the fact that he had been wearing sunglasses. The day was not that bright. Had his disappearance while Strike's view was occluded been coincidental or deliberate? The trouble was that Strike could place little reliance on his memories of what the three men who were currently preoccupying him looked like, because he had not seen Brockbank for 8 years, Lang for 9, and Whittaker for 16. Any of them might have grown fat or wasted in that time, lost their hair, become bearded or moustached, be incapacitated or newly muscled,
Strike himself had lost a leg since he had last set eyes on any of them. The one thing that nobody could disguise was height. All three of the men Strike was concerned about had been 6 feet tall or over, and camouflage jacket had looked at least that in his metal chair. The phone in his pocket buzzed as he walked towards Tottenham Court Road Station, and on pulling it out of his pocket he saw, to his pleasure, that it was Graham Hardacre. Drawing aside so as not to impede passers-by, he answered.
"Oggy," said his ex-colleague's voice.
"What gives, mate? Why are people sending you legs?"
"I take it you're not in Germany," said Strike.
"Edinburgh. Been here 6 weeks. Just been reading about you in the Scotsman."
The Special Investigation Branch of the Royal Military Police had an office in Edinburgh Castle, 35 section. It was a prestigious posting.
"Hardy, I need a favour," said Strike. "Intel on a couple of guys. Do you remember Noel Brockbank?"
"Hard to forget. 7th Armoured, if memory serves."
"That's him. The other one's Donald Lang. He was before I knew you. King's own Royal Borderers. Knew him in Cyprus."
"I'll see what I can do when I get back to the office, mate. I'm in the middle of a ploughed field right now."
A chat about mutual acquaintances was curtailed by the increasing noise of rush-hour traffic. Hardacre promised to ring back once he had had a look at the army records, and Strike continued towards the tube. He got out at Whitechapel Station 30 minutes later to find a text message from the man he was supposed to be meeting.
"Sorry, Bunsen, can't do today, I'll give you a bell."
This was both disappointing and inconvenient, but not a surprise. Considering that Strike was not carrying a consignment of drugs or a large pile of used notes, and that he did not require intimidation or beating, it was a mark of great esteem that Shanker had even condescended to fix a time and place for meeting. Strike's knee was complaining after a day on his feet, but there were no seats outside the station. He leaned up against the yellow brick wall beside the entrance and called Shanker's number.
"Yeah, all right, Bunsen."
Just as he no longer remembered why Shanker was called Shanker, he had no more idea why Shanker called him Bunsen. They had met when they were 17, and the connection between them, though profound in its way, bore none of the usual stigmata of teenage friendship. In fact, it had not been a friendship in any usual sense, but more like an enforced brotherhood. Strike was sure that Shanker would mourn his passing were he to die, but he was equally certain that Shanker would rob his body of all valuables if left alone with it. What others might not understand was that Shanker would do so in the belief that Strike would be glad, in whatever afterworld he was dwelling, to think that it was Shanker who had his wallet, rather than some anonymous opportunist.
"You're busy, Shanker?"
asked Strike, lighting a fresh cigarette.
"Yeah, Bunsen, no chance today. What's happening?"
"I'm looking for Whittaker."
"Gonna finish it, are you?"
The change in Shanker's tone would have alarmed anyone who had forgotten who Shanker was, what he was. To Shanker and his associates, there was no proper end to a grudge other than killing, and in consequence, he had spent half his adult life behind bars. Strike was surprised Shanker had survived into his mid-30s.
"I just want to know where he is," said Strike repressively.
He doubted that Shanker would have heard about the leg. Shanker lived in a world where news was a strictly personal interest and was conveyed by word of mouth.
"I can have an ask around."
"Usual rates," said Strike,
who had a standing arrangement with Shanker for useful bits of information.
"And Shanker?"
His old friend had a habit of hanging up without warning when his attention was diverted.
"Is there more?"
said Shanker, his voice moving from distant to close as he spoke. Strike had been right to think he had removed the mobile from his ear, assuming they were done.
"Yeah," said Strike. "Digger Malley."
A silence on the end of the line eloquently expressed the fact that, just as Strike never forgot what Shanker was, nor did Shanker ever forget what Strike was.
"Shanker, this is between you and me, no one else.
You've never discussed me with Mally, have you?
After a pause, and in his most dangerous voice, Shanker said,
The fuck would I do that for?
Had to ask. I'll explain when I see you.
The dangerous silence continued.
Shanker, when have I ever grassed you up? Asked Strike.
Another shorter silence, and then Shanker said in what to Strike was his normal voice,
Yeah, all right. Whittaker, huh? See what I can do, Bunsen.
The line went dead. Shanker did not do goodbyes. Strike sighed and lit up another cigarette. The journey had been pointless. He would get straight back on a train once he had finished his Benson and Hedges. The station entrance gave onto a kind of concrete forecourt surrounded by the backs of buildings. The Gherkin, that giant black bullet of a building, glinted on the distant horizon. It had not been there 20 years previously, during Strike's family's brief sojourn in Whitechapel. Looking around, Strike felt no sense of homecoming or nostalgia. He could not remember this patch of concrete, these nondescript rears of buildings. Even the station seemed only dimly familiar. The endless series of moves and upheavals that had characterized life with his mother had blurred memories of individual places. He sometimes forgot which corner shop had belonged to which run-down flat, which local pub had adjoined which squat. He had meant to get back on the tube, and yet before he knew it, he was walking, heading for the one place in London he had avoided for 17 years. The building where his mother had died. It had been the last of Leda's squats, two floors of a decrepit building on Fulbourn Street, which was barely a minute from the station. As he walked, Strike began to remember. Of course. He had walked over this metal bridge over the railway line during his A-level year. He remembered the name, Castlemaine Street, too. Surely one of his fellow A-level students, a girl with a pronounced lisp, had lived there. He slowed to an amble as he reached the end of Fulbourn Street, experiencing a strange double impression. His vague memory of the place, weakened no doubt by his deliberate attempts to forget, lay like a faded transparency over the scene in front of his eyes. The buildings were as shabby as he remembered them, white plaster peeling away from the frontages, but the businesses and shops were totally unfamiliar. He felt as though he had returned to a dreamscape where the scene had shifted and mutated. Of course, everything was impermanent in the poor areas of London, where fragile fair-weather businesses grew up and faded away and were replaced. Cheap signage tacked up and removed, people passing through, passing away. It took him a minute or two to identify the door of what had once been the squat, because he had forgotten the number. At last he found it, beside a shop selling cheap clothing of both Asian and Western varieties, which he thought had been a West Indian supermarket in his day. The brass letterbox brought back a strange stab of memory. It had rattled loudly whenever anyone went in or out of the door.
Fuck, fuck, fuck.
Lighting a second cigarette from the tip of the first, he walked briskly out onto Whitechapel Road, where market stalls stood. More cheap clothing, a multitude of gaudy plastic goods. Strike sped up, walking he was not sure where, and some of what he passed triggered more memories. That snooker hall had been there 17 years ago, so had the bell foundry. And now the memories were rising to bite him as though he had trodden on a nest of sleeping snakes. As she neared 40, his mother had begun to go for younger men, but Whittaker had been the youngest of the lot. 21, when she had started sleeping with him. Her son had been 16 when she first brought Whittaker home. The musician had looked ravaged even then, with sallow hollows under his wide-apart eyes, which were a striking golden hazel. His dark hair fell in dreadlocks to his shoulders. He lived in the same T-shirt and jeans, and consequently stank. A well-worn phrase kept echoing in Strike's head, keeping pace with his footsteps as he trudged down Whitechapel Road. Hiding in plain sight. Hiding in plain sight. Of course, people would think he was obsessed, biased, unable to let go. They would say his thoughts had jumped to Whittaker when he saw the leg in the box, because he had never got over the fact that Whittaker had walked free on the charge of killing Strike's mother. Even if Strike explained his reasons for suspecting Whittaker, they would probably laugh at the notion that such an ostentatious lover of the perverse and the sadistic could have cut off a woman's leg. Strike knew how deeply ingrained was the belief that the evil conceal their dangerous predilections for violence and domination. When they wear them like bangles for all to see, the gullible populace laughs, calls it a pose, or finds it strangely attractive. Leda had met Whittaker at the record company where she worked as a receptionist, a minor, living piece of rock history, employed as a kind of totem on the front desk. Whittaker, who played the guitar and wrote lyrics for a succession of thrash metal bands that, one by one, threw him out because of his histrionics, substance abuse and aggression, claimed to have met Leda while pursuing a record deal. However, Leda had confided to Strike that their first encounter had happened while she was trying to persuade security not to be so rough with the young man they were throwing out. She had brought him home, and Whittaker had never left. The 16-year-old Strike had not been sure whether or not Whittaker's gloating open pleasure in everything that was sadistic and demonic was genuine or a pose. All he had known was that he hated Whittaker with a visceral loathing that had transcended anything he had felt for any of the other lovers whom Leda had taken up, then left behind. He had been forced to breathe in the man's stench as he did his homework of an evening in the squat. He had almost been able to taste him. Whittaker tried patronizing the teenager. Sudden explosions and waspish put-downs revealed an articulacy he was careful to hide when he wished to ingratiate himself with Leda's less educated friends. But Strike had been ready with put-downs and comebacks of his own, and he had the advantage of being less stoned than Whittaker, or at least, only as stoned as a person could be living in a constant fug of cannabis smoke. Out of Leda's hearing, Whittaker had jeered at Strike's determination to continue his oft-disrupted education. Whittaker was tall and wiry, surprisingly well-muscled for one who lived an almost entirely sedentary life. Strike was already over 6 feet, and boxing at a local club. The tension between the two stiffened the smoky air whenever both were present, the threat of violence constant. Whittaker had driven Strike's half-sister Lucy away for good with his bullying, his sexual taunts and sneers. He had strutted around the squat naked, scratching his tattooed torso, laughing at the 14-year-old girl's mortification. One night she had run to the telephone box at the corner of the street and begged their aunt and uncle in Cornwall to come and fetch her. They had arrived at the squat at dawn next day, having driven overnight from St. Maur's. Lucy was ready with her meagre possessions in a small suitcase. She had never lived with her mother again. Ted and Joan had stood on the doorstep and pleaded with Strike to come too. He had refused, his resolve hardening with every plea Joan made, determined to sit Whittaker out, not to leave him alone with his mother. By now, he had heard Whittaker talking lucidly about what it would feel like to take a life, as though it were an Epicurean treat. He had not believed then that Whittaker meant it, but he had known him capable of violence, and had seen him threaten their fellow squatters. Once, Leda refused to believe it had happened, Strike had witnessed Whittaker attempt to bludgeon a cat that had inadvertently woken him from a doze. Strike had wrested the heavy boot from Whittaker's hand as he chased the terrified cat around the room, swinging at it, screaming and swearing, determined to make the animal pay. The knee onto which the prosthesis was fitted was beginning to complain as Strike strode faster and faster along the street. The Nag's Head pub rose up on the right as though he had conjured it, squat, square, and brick. Only at the door did he catch sight of the dark-clad bouncer and remember that the Nag's Head was another lap-dancing club these days.
"Bollocks," he muttered.
He had no objection to semi-clad women gyrating around him while he enjoyed a pint,